This is the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the flight of Apollo 17. We'll return to Cape Kennedy for the countdown and launch following a summary of world news.
Launching of the Apollo 17 spacecraft has been halted 30 seconds before liftoff and delayed for at least an hour. Technicians believe the trouble was caused by a pressure failure in the liquid oxygen tanks. The launching was halted by an automatic device called the terminal sequencer. This device makes certain that an action is completed before the next action is started. A spokesman said technicians in the blockhouse saw the pressure in the oxygen tanks was too low and sought to pump it up manually, but were unable to get it up to the proper point before the terminal sequencer automatically cut it off. Officials say the launch team will recycle the countdown and start at a T-minus 22-minute mark. The recycling procedure will take an additional 35 to 40 minutes. This means the launching may be delayed for as much as an hour. While the recycling is taking place, the engineers and technicians will review the data to determine if there is anything to prevent the launching. The three astronauts, meanwhile, are remaining in the space vehicle. They are said to be in no immediate danger. Former President Harry Truman is now in critical condition at a Kansas City, Missouri hospital. VOA correspondent Robert Lodge has this report.
Mr. Truman was brought to the hospital in fair condition, later was judged to be serious, and now is described as in critical condition. This means there are major complications and his death may be imminent. The 88-year-old Mr. Truman is suffering from lung congestion and bronchitis. Doctors, concerned that this may be too much for his heart, say his heart rate has been irregular or rapid at times. Mrs. Truman has returned to the hospital, and their daughter, Mrs. Clifton Daniel of New York, also is on her way. The hospital says the former president has shown a very slight improvement, but his condition continues to be critical. No further details will be made public until later. This is Robert Lodge, VOA, Kansas City.
The United States, Britain, France, and West Germany are reported to have reached an understanding on future contacts with East Germany. The subject was discussed at a dinner in Brussels by Secretary of State Rogers and his British, French, and West German counterparts on the eve of the NATO Council meeting. U.S. sources said the consensus is that between the dates of the signing and the ratification of the Inter-German Treaty, the four Western countries will each decide at what pace and at what level to open contacts with East Germany. 18 non-aligned countries have introduced a draft resolution calling on UN members to cut off aid to Israel unless Israel pledges to withdraw from occupied territory. The delegate of Senegal, speaking for the 18 nations, formally proposed the resolution as the UN General Assembly continued debating the Mideast question. On Tuesday, Israel warned that passage of the resolution may jeopardize Mideast peace efforts. The top American and North Vietnamese negotiators will have another private meeting in Paris today on a Vietnam peace agreement. Presidential advisor Henry Kissinger and Hanoi's Lê Duc Tho talked for 5.5 hours Wednesday. As usual, there were no details of the discussions. But the White House says that Mr. Kissinger has been receiving further instructions from President Nixon by cable. Our correspondent in Saigon reports that President Tu and other South Vietnamese leaders are conferring almost daily on the progress of the Paris talks. The pro-government newspaper Tin Song said the talks may be prolonged unless South Vietnam's demands for a guaranteed and just peace are met. Soviet President Podgorny has pledged his country's support for the revolutionary programs of Chile's President Allende. In a speech welcoming President Allende to the Soviet Union, Mr. Podgorny praised Chile's fight for political and economic independence. Earlier, the Soviet news agency reported that official talks with the Chilean president began in an atmosphere of friendship and absolute understanding. President Allende is expected to seek further economic assistance for Chile from the Soviet Union. In Washington, the State Department denied President Allende's charge earlier this week of an economic blockade. It cited Chile's delay in paying its debts as a likely cause of reluctance by foreign investors to extend the country further credit. President Allende is to visit Cuba and Venezuela before returning to Santiago. Ugandan President Idi Amin has warned again of a drastic decision when he meets with British nationals in Uganda later this month. He told a group of army officers that he seeks to clear the country of what he called all obstacles so that the Ugandan people can be masters of everything in their country. President Amin said the nation must rid itself of what he termed British imperialists who are milking the country's economy. His new warning follows Britain's announcement last week that no further British aid will be given Uganda once existing commitments are fulfilled. About 3,000 industrial workers stormed a Dhaka jail Wednesday and released two labor leaders being held on charges of possessing unauthorized arms. An attempt to release nine others failed when police fired blanks to disperse the mob. A 15-hour curfew was imposed on Dhaka's industrial areas following the incident. The Australian and Chinese ambassadors to France conferred for an hour in Paris on establishing diplomatic relations. Australian envoy Alan Renouf gave no details on the meeting with Chinese Ambassador Huang Zheng, but he predicted embassies would be established in both countries before Prime Minister Gough Whitlam's expected Peking visit in October. The new Australian leader has said October would be a reasonable time for a China visit because he will attend a Japan-Australia ministerial meeting in Tokyo around that time. More announcements from President Nixon on his second-term administration. The head of a textile mill in South Carolina, Frederick Dent, will become the new Secretary of Commerce, replacing Peter Peterson. Mr. Peterson will become a special representative, traveling to several countries to report on how the United States can better coordinate its economic policies with its trading partners. Agriculture Secretary Earl Butts will remain at his post. President Nixon has praised the Secretary General of the United Nations for his firm stand against international terrorism. Mr. Nixon made the comment in response to a message Secretary General Waldheim sent him after his re-election. The President said he looks forward to working with the Secretary General and other world leaders to build a structure of lasting peace. The White House says King Hussein of Jordan is expected to visit the United States in the near future. A White House spokesman said President Nixon undoubtedly will meet with the Jordanian leader during the visit. In a recent interview, King Hussein said his visit will take place early next year. Syrian Defense Minister Tlass is in Moscow at the invitation of his Soviet counterpart, Marshal Grechko. Reports say Soviet military aid to Syria is expected to be a major topic of talks. The first talks between the two defense ministers took place Wednesday night and were described as friendly. Later, Marshal Grechko entertained the Syrian minister at a dinner. Here again are the top stories at this hour. The launching of the Apollo 17 moon mission has been delayed at least an hour. Condition of former President Truman worsens. Britain, France, the United States, and West Germany reportedly agree on future contacts with East Germany. That's the news. Mel Johnston reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the flight of Apollo 17. The countdown has resumed, and we return to correspondent Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy.
9 minutes, 20 seconds, and counting. Let's go to launch control.
The crew has been alerted aboard the spacecraft. Cernan indicated that perhaps they could start a nice conversation about a good book, Thomas Hardy or something like that. Countdown continuing now, aiming toward the 8-minute mark, at which time we'll hold. T-minus 9 minutes now, T-minus 9 minutes and counting. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
This is an unusually jocular crew. It began back at the place where they were suiting up. And Don Beatty, I believe that you saw an interesting sight there, right?
Well, as the crew came out to go aboard the van that takes them out to the rocket, We saw Ron Evans do just a little bit of a jig before he climbed aboard, and then when everyone was aboard and they attempted to close the door...
On the van.
One of the crew, we couldn't tell for sure which one, got up quickly and put his foot in the door so they couldn't close the door as if he didn't want to go, but then, of course, he backed off and they closed the door.
So they were really keyed up and ready, and as they say, they were in limbo for a few minutes, wondering what had happened and what decision was to be made on resuming the count. So everybody apparently is happy to find that they can pressurize the tank properly. Coming up on that eight-minute mark for a go, no-go on continuing the count, right now, 8 minutes... We should have something from launch control. There's a hold at 8 minutes. The clock has stopped. Let's see if launch control has anything to report to us. The clock has stopped counting at 8 minutes.
Just a few minutes ago, they mentioned that they were planning to hold.
This is Apollo Saturn launch control. We're now holding at the eight-minute mark as planned. The hold at this time is planned for approximately 20 minutes. The crew feels that they have a workaround to the problem, working around the indication going to the terminal sequencer that the tank has not been pressurized when actually it had been done manually. They are checking all of their data, however, to ensure that this is the proper method to work around the problem and that this will result in a smooth countdown from here on. Now T-minus 8 minutes and holding. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
Well, I hope they keep up their good spirits up there in the command module, and apparently they have been from the little inklings we've been getting of the exchange back and forth with Mission Control. T-minus 8 minutes and holding, and as you just heard, Hollingshead report, that hold will last for about 20 minutes, so we're going to be here a while before this bird blasts off into the heavens. Let's listen to the third member of the crew. We've heard... something about the personalities and backgrounds of both Gene Cernan, the commander, and Jack Schmidt, the scientist geologist. Jim Parisi recorded this conversation with Ron Evans in Houston about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Where were you born?
I was born in a small town in St. Francis, Kansas. It's the last town in the northwest corner of the state of Kansas.
And tell us a little about your schooling and your road to becoming an astronaut.
Essentially, went to grade school in St. Francis, Kansas, moved to Topeka, Kansas, went to high school at Highland Park High School in Topeka, and then on to the University of Kansas. And while at the University of Kansas, I was in the Navy ROTC unit and then got my commission in the Navy upon graduation, upon graduating from the University of Kansas. Went into pilot training in the Navy. And then got assigned in a fighter squadron on the West Coast. And then throughout the career there, picked up a master's degree in aeronautical engineering from the Navy postgraduate school. And made three, four carrier deployments. The fighter squadrons get assigned to aircraft carriers, and then you deploy to the Far East. In my case, I was always a West Coast sailor. And they deployed to the Far East. And the last assignment I had, oddly enough, was on the carrier Ticonderoga, which is going to be the recovery carrier for our flight. So I'll get back on the carrier Ticonderoga. And this was out in Vietnam waters the last time I was out on it. And so I flew about 100 missions over in Vietnam just before I was selected to participate in the astronaut program.
Well, now, you've had several simulated journeys into space, but this is your first real thing, isn't it?
This is the first time where I'll actually get the opportunity to fly. I've been on the astronaut support crew for Apollo 7 and Apollo 11, and on the backup crew for Apollo 14, and then on the prime crew for Apollo 17.
Well, I'm sure you're looking forward to that day of takeoff.
I sure am. I really am.
Well, the best to you. Ron Evans, command module pilot for Apollo 17. And from Houston, Texas, and the Manned Spacecraft Center, for Voice of America, this is Jim Parisi.
Let's go back to launch control and pick up with Chuck Hollingshead. He's describing what they're going to do to work around the sequencer problem.
This is a normal condition. Actually, during the day, this burns in such a pure manner that it cannot be seen. However, at night, it is clearly visible.
He's talking about
our
the liquid
countdown
oxygen
continuing to hold at the T-minus 8 minute mark at this time. T-minus 8 minutes and holding. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
He's talking about the way that these vapors boil off and spew out into the sky. We can always see the liquid oxygen when it vaporizes. It looks like a white cloud streaming out from the middle of the great rocket, but there's some other fumes that spill overboard and are exhausted from the rocket that we normally don't see in the daytime, he just reported. So television viewers around the world are seeing an unusual sight for this night launch. Those of you in Europe, in the Far East, North and South America, who may be watching television, and we hope some of you may be listening for our audio radio description here on the Voice of America as we're at Cape Kennedy to describe the liftoff of Apollo 17. It's been delayed now just about an hour and a half because a terminal sequencer, as it's called, part of the automatic countdown procedure, shut down the count at T-minus 30 seconds. The automatic control detected that the third stage liquid oxygen tank was not pressurizing fast enough under the automatic system. The engineers in the control center and the flight center saw this and punched manual and pressurized it manually, but not quick enough to catch that automatic monitoring system, which then actuated the shutdown at T-minus 30 seconds. And they've spent about an hour and 20 minutes or so now analyzing it. The countdown has been recycled to T-minus 22 minutes, counted down to T-minus 8 minutes, and the clock has stopped. And we heard the report just a few minutes ago that it will be stopped at this 8-minute mark for about another 15 minutes while the engineers prepare what they call their workaround. Now, in this, they are preparing some manual procedures in order to bypass this terminal sequence automatic shutdown mechanism when it gets to that T-minus 30-second mark again. That the way you understand it, Don Beatty?
That's the way I understood the information we were getting on the situation, Red.
So the engineers don't believe that anything is wrong with pressurizing that third-stage liquid oxygen tank, so they're going to perform their workaround and make sure that it's done manually if necessary so that the final countdown sequence can go all the way to zero.
This is one of those little gremlins that always occur when you have a complicated beast like this, and maybe we'll never know exactly what happened on it, but these things crop up from time to time, and almost every mission we've had these little things come up.
Well, if this rascal goes out there in about another 20, 25 minutes, we certainly won't ever get a close look at it again. It'll be gone. First and second stage will be up out in the ocean. The third stage will impact upon the moon.
Well, of course, they now have in the data bank all of the telemetry that came back giving an indication of the problem, and this will be analyzed exhaustively in the days ahead. One of the reasons being, of course, that we plan to use a Saturn V in early spring of next year to start our Skylab program, so we want to make sure that we understand what the problem was, if possible.
Let's get back to that Skylab program in just a few minutes. That's where we go from here with American men in space after Apollo. I've continually emphasized or repeatedly mentioned that this is the last moon landing, but there are to be three more manned flights by the United States next year in an Earth-orbiting workshop that's called Skylab, and we'll be talking about that in the days to come. Maybe we'll have a little time before this liftoff gets off, too. I'd like for us to play another one of these conversations with the crew. These are the men we're going to be hearing from after liftoff all the way to the moon and back. It's, again, a high-spirited crew, as we've had on several of these shots in the past. Gene Cernan, Ron Evans, and Jack Schmidt, Jack Schmidt, the scientist astronaut, the only scientist we're going to send to the moon in the foreseeable future, the geologist who himself has helped prepare all of these other moonwalkers and has helped lay out the very excursions. He's helped plan the moon maps and tell Dave Scott and Jim Irwin and John Young where to go, and Charlie Duke, where to go on the moon to find the most interesting geological pieces of rock and soil to pick up. And now he himself is going, and he's a very bright an interesting person. We'll be hearing a lot from Jack Schmidt, from Ron Evans, who will stay in the command module and stay in lunar orbit performing an immense amount of scientific research with the onboard instruments, some extremely complex, sophisticated instrumentation there in what is called the Scientific Instrument Module, or bay, the SIM bay, with panoramic cameras, with sensors to detect all sorts of phenomena from the moon and out into space. And we'll hear from Ron, too. We won't hear too much during the time that the Challenger is on the surface of the moon, because then at that time, Schmidt and Cernan will be dominating most of the air-to-ground conversations. Ron will be fairly silent to, as far as those of us listening on Earth are concerned, but he'll be there performing an immense amount of scientific data. Gene Cernan recorded this little conversation. He's the commander of the mission, I remember. And here is the way he told Jim Parisi just a few days ago in Houston about the landing site and the possible difficulties which may be encountered in bringing the lunar module Challenger down in between two mountain massifs or mountain ranges. Let's listen to that conversation.
Gene, the Taurus-Littrow site that you're heading for on Apollo 17 gives you some special landing problems that have never been faced before, doesn't it?
Well, it does, particularly in the targeting that the ground has to do to get us into this area. It's sort of a box canyon. We have a very mountainous area. We have mountains both to the north and the south of our landing site that go up to 7,000 feet. And there's only an area of about 5 kilometers between these mountains that are accessible to land in. We also land over mountains that are upwards of 6,000 feet. We have in front of us a cliff-like structure, a scarp that is 80 to 100 meters high, which is going to look bigger and bigger the closer we get to the surface. So the big picture of the landing site, as far as the difficulty of getting into, is really quite different than what we've ever done in the past. We don't have the room for error in terms of targeting our vehicle into this area. However, when we actually get down to the last few hundred feet or last few hundred meters just prior to landing, the site, although it's quite rough and it's quite crater-filled, really should not be that much different than Apollo 16's landing site. So when you get down to that point, you have to, there's no one else who can help you but yourself. You've got to look out that window. You've got to find an area that is free of boulders, an area that's free of craters, maneuver the spacecraft over, and land it. And you have to do all that in a hurry because we don't have the privilege of carrying a great deal of extra fuel with us.
Well, you've seen the site, and as a matter of fact, you've tried to land on it many, many times in simulation here on Earth, and you'll have many chances to see it before you actually land in the lunar environment, too, won't you?
Well, we'll pass over the site several times prior to landing, but we'll be at an altitude the first two times around in 150 to 170 miles where you can't, the resolution of what you can see is not what you'd like to see. I'd like to see those little holes that are two and 3 meters across, because those are the ones that eventually we're going to have to avoid when it comes down to the final landing.
Well, in the final landing, as you come toward or into the landing site, are you going to be able to see it a good distance before you actually get to it?
Yes, we actually have a view of the landing site when we're 7,000 feet in the air, and this is all probably 2 or 3 minutes of flying time prior to the actual touchdown point. And it sounds like a lot of time, and it sounds like a great distance at which to view the landing site, but believe me, that time period progresses very rapidly, and the decisions that have to be made at that point in time have to be made on a basis of instinct, and a basis of training, and a basis of best judgment at that point in time.
Incidentally, it's called Taurus-Littrow, the landing area. Tell us why.
Well, the landing area itself is on the southeastern side of the Great Basin of Serenitatis, which is a very large desert-like basin on the moon, and it's bordered by the Taurus Mountains, and then there's another crater, a smaller crater, by small, it's still several kilometers across, called Littrow. And there was really no designation for this area when it was picked as a landing site. So the combination of the Taurus Mountains and a crater Littrow, it was named Taurus Littrow.
And the names come from where?
Well, the names come from the history of visual exploration of the moon that goes back far beyond Apollo. Names that were given by astronomers and explorers and people who looked at the moon many, many years before I even got interested in it, I guess.
But there's a mountain range here on Earth called Taurus, isn't there?
You know, I'm not aware of that. I'm glad you told me. Where is it?
In Turkey.
Is that right?
As a matter of fact, yes. And then Littrow was the Austrian astronomer. Well, you will soon be seeing the site right there, and I wish you the best for that. Talking with Gene Cernan, commander of Apollo 17. This is Jim Parisi from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
Don Beatty, we were just listening to that description of the Taurus and Littrow, the Taurus Mountains in Turkey, Littrow the astronomer. Did you study any of that when you were in school, any of their, of Littrow's work?
No, I don't recall that I did, Rhett. There are a number of interesting sidelights about this particular site that we're going to. It would be really a second-generation site. It's a site that we didn't have on our original list of sites to go to on the moon. However, after Apollo 15, when we got our first really outstanding, highly detailed photography, we were able to see this site, and it came out as a very high-priority site based on what we were able to observe from that photography.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Jack Schmidt played a very active role in all of this mission planning for the EVAs and the surface activities, I recall. I think I've reported that in the past. And now he's there, the professional geologist on the surface of the moon, and will be on this flight, or whenever it gets off the pad out there. T-minus 8 minutes and holding still. We'll pick up the count shortly. We're just waiting to hear from flight control. Don, also, we haven't mentioned the little passengers on this flight. There are three men aboard, but there are also five passengers, I understand.
Well, that's right. This mission is unique in the fact that the rocket's going to lift off with eight passengers aboard. The first three, of course, are the astronaut crew, but in addition, we have five pocket mice.
Pocket mice.
Yes, that's right. These are little rodents that live in our southwestern deserts, and they have been put on board to study the effects of cosmic ray bombardment on tissue. And these mice will be analyzed, and in fact, when the crew gets back, the container that they are housed in will be one of the first things that's taken off, and there'll be an eager group of scientists will immediately rush these pocket mice to Samoa and do an analysis of what has gone on during the flight.
So for the first time, there will be some people anxious to poke and examine something live other than the astronauts when they get back.
Of course, one of the jokes prior to launch has been whether the crew is carrying a mousetrap along with them just in case one of the mice gets loose and starts floating around inside the cabin. And what does a zero-G mousetrap look like?
What does a zero-G mouse look like floating around inside the spacecraft? So there were a lot of, jokes among those of you preparing the mission, huh? Well, let's listen to Jack Schmidt, Dr. Jack Schmidt himself, describe the experiments on the ALSEP package, which he is going to help deploy on the surface of the moon. This also, of course, recorded several weeks ago.
Jack, the acronym ALSEP means Apollo Lunar Scientific Experiment Package, and you're taking one to the surface of the moon. Tell us what new experiments are contained in this one that is different from the previous Apollo missions.
The experiments package that we have on Apollo 17 is almost completely new. There is only one experiment that has been flown previously, and that's the experiment that measures the flow or flux of heat from the deep interior of the moon, the heat flow experiment. We are flying that, and it's essentially the same experiment that's been flown on several other missions. The new experiments, probably the most important and potentially the most exciting one to science in general, is the lunar surface gravimeter. Now, this is a very, very sensitive gravity meter that can measure changes over long periods of time, such as the tides, the lunar tides, the change in elevation that the moon goes through as it is affected by the Earth, and that's very, very slight. It is so sensitive, though. The main purpose of it being there, though, is to detect long-period oscillations of the moon, which would occur if gravity waves passed through this portion of space. Now, gravity waves is something that the principal investigator whose experiment this is has been very interested in for a long period of time and has recently felt that he has detected waves that represent pulsations in a gravity field. And these may be coming from the center of the galaxy. Now, this is pure speculation at this time, but the surface gravimeter is designed primarily to help the astronomers, really, study and understand gravity. And, of course, the implications of understanding gravity are, potential implications are comparable to those that if we could have sat and said, maybe we'll understand radioactivity some many decades ago, then you can see now what the implications of understanding that were. Most of them good, not all of them good, but nevertheless, understanding means that we will be able to use these kind of waves, if you will, for other purposes, hopefully. There's a lunar ejecta and meteoroid experiment, which is going to be look at the small particles that are impacting the moon and also being moved about on the moon. There is a lunar surface mass spectrometer that will be measuring in a very detailed way the volatile or the gaseous components that may be drifting around on the moon that we know, in fact, are in the soils and almost certainly are moving a sort of lunar atmosphere, but very, very thin atmosphere. There's a three new experiments that are related to our use of the rover, or the lunar roving vehicle. One of those is a revised and much augmented lunar surface active seismic experiment. We will be deploying a geophone array, that is an array of sensors, and an array of fairly large explosive packages that after we leave, some 90 hours after we leave, these will be activated by command from the Earth and exploded, and the again, using seismic energy, we'll explore, if you will, the internal structure of the floor of the valley that we have landed in. There's the Traverse gravimeter, which is, again, is similar in concept to the gravity meter that I mentioned before, except it's less sensitive, and it's designed primarily to look at the variations in the gravity field of the moon, which, again, relate to differences in density of materials within the moon itself, and therefore we get more information on the crustal structure. And finally, the surface electrical properties experiment, which I alluded to earlier, is basically a radio wave experiment that has a transmitter that sends radio waves through the materials of the valley. And these are picked up and recorded by a receiver that's mounted on the rover, and the correlation of that recorded data with the position of the rover at any given time will give information, again, on the internal structure of the valley floor and potentially on the presence or absence of water.
And these are not just a one-shot thing. All of these experiments are going to be useful to us for some time in the future, aren't they?
Yes, the package is designed to last at least 3 years, and most of the ALSEP, or the surface packages we have left, have lasted beyond their design lifetime.
Well, a year's worth information for the same number of days that you will have spent on the surface of the moon is well worth the trip, I would think.
I think so. The combination of that plus the additional observations we can make and samples we can gather while we're there makes it almost an unbeatable effort in terms of man's exploration of the universe.
Jack Schmidt, lunar module pilot for Apollo 17, talking with him here in November, just a few weeks before Apollo 17 gets on its way. Talking with him here at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. I'm Jim Parisi for the Voice of America.
You're listening to the Voice of America's live coverage of the launch of Apollo 17, the last of the Apollo series of missions to explore the moon. This is Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy with Don Beatty of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Don has been spending many, many hours, and in fact, you've spent years in working on preparing this lunar exploration and the activities on the surface of the moon. And that's something that we're anxiously looking toward being most fruitful on this mission. And Don and I'll talk some more about that. He was talking about this ALSEP package, this experiments package on the moon. Now, this has been one of the most long-lived and successful of all of the Apollo devices, because the thing's still working all the way back to Apollo 11, isn't it? That's back to 1969 in July.
Well, actually, the Apollo 12 mission was the first one that we put an ALSEP on. And that particular ALSEP is now in its fourth year of continuous operation, functioning absolutely normally, sending us back interesting scientific data every day, 24 hours a day. And in the last ALSEP, on Apollo 16, which was our fourth ALSEP, is now in its ninth month of operation and operating very successfully.
So there are four then, not five.
That's right.
I see. Let's see. Refresh my memory. The power supply finally went out on the Apollo 11 package, didn't
it? Well, the Apollo 11 package...
It didn't have the thermal generator.
Did not have a radioisotope thermoelectric generator on it. It was powered by solar panels, and it was only designed to actually last through one lunar cycle, which it did.
Lunar cycle meaning one 28-day period.
And it was our first attempt to get information of this type back from the moon. Worked very successfully. Actually, it worked intermittently beyond that period of time, but eventually we turned it off.
Mm-hmm. These radioactive thermal generators, the things with the radioisotope in them, now, you've with Apollo 12, that one has lasted 4 years, far beyond its design lifetime, hasn't it?
That's right. Our original design goal was a year for these instruments, or these stations, and all of them now are operating 4 or 3 or 2 years, and the radioisotope thermoelectric generator actually will put out power for a long period of time. The half-life of the isotope that we're using there is about 80 years. Mm-hmm. So power-wise, those stations could work on into the indefinite future. Probably what would happen is that we'll get other electronic failures prior to that time, but at this point in time, they're all very healthy and working very satisfactorily.
Let's get back to that projected lifetime and what we might expect, what sort of information we might expect in years to come if it continues to operate properly on all of these ALSEP packages. But first, let me refresh our listeners on what's happening here in the countdown procedure. We're at T-minus 8 minutes and holding. We have completed one 20-minute countdown, one 20-minute hold in the count while the engineers were preparing their workaround solution on how to get around this automatic sequencer that shut down at 30 seconds before liftoff because of a pressurization problem. And an additional 20-minute hold has been announced because they want to prove out in what's called a breadboard engineering mechanism at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, the workaround solution that they have come up with. In other words, where the rocket was designed and built at the Marshall Space Flight Center, they have a what might be called a mock-up. That might be a simplified way of describing it. A mock-up mechanism which can simulate this proposed solution, this workaround. And they want, and Gene Cernan and Ron Evans and Jack Schmidt said, well, we want all three of those stages to work because we want to get there, and we are perfectly happy to wait another 20 minutes so you can make sure all three of these stages do work. Here's launch control.
Hold at the T-minus 8-minute mark. The reason the T-minus 8-minute mark is chosen for this hold, as mentioned earlier, has to do with the chill down of the thrust chambers in the S2 or second stage and the third stage. Both of these stages use liquid hydrogen, an extremely cold or cryogenic fuel, and the thrust chamber must be conditioned prior to flight so that it's ready at the time of ignition in flight to receive these fuels coming in. To achieve the proper temperature, the thrust chamber chill down should not exceed 20 minutes, but it must be on for at least 7 minutes and 40 seconds. So rounding that off, the hold was called at the 8-minute mark. We can continuously hold it at this point, whereas if we continued on down, we would have to watch these parameters very closely so that we did not exceed that 20-minute accumulated cooling time. At this point, we can continue our hold, and that continuation can be determined by the problem, and we can pick up then at any time or continue as long as necessary. We're continuing that hold now. T-minus 8 minutes and holding. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
And I might reiterate again why the hold. He just explained why the hold is held at 8 minutes, and I had just completed telling you why they are continuing to hold, and that is for the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama to run a simulation with their mock-up, their breadboard design of this sequencer, so that they can check out the solution or the workaround solution they have devised in order to get the countdown all the way. Don Beatty?
Yeah, your listeners may be interested to know, Rhett, that actually we have this ability to look at problems on all the major components of the launch vehicle and the spacecraft. We have mock-ups or simulators of the LEM, the command service module, the various stages. We even carry simulators that we can look at of the roving vehicle, the experiments that we carry to the moon. And if we run into a problem on any of these systems, we can go directly to a high-fidelity mock-up and try and check out a workaround if we need it.
I remember during the Apollo 13 flight to the moon, when they had when the whole side blew out, Gene Cernan went into a simulator. The man who's the commander of this flight went over into a simulator to see if they could make sure that the lunar module would indeed become a lifeboat to help bring the two spacecraft back to Earth. And Jim Lovell and Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes stayed connected with the lunar module, went around the moon, and returned to Earth safely. And the man who's the commander of this flight was one of the men who proved out the method which brought them home safely in a simulator in Houston.
Yes, what he actually did was make sure that there was sufficient power, sufficient oxygen, that they could come up with a profile that would allow the astronauts to do the most that they could and still have a reserve when they get back to Earth.
Mm-hmm. So that was really a matter of statistical tabulation on consumables, as they call them, oxygen and power and water and cooling, heating. They got pretty cold. I remember Fred Hayes came back a sick boy. He had a pretty bad cold or virus by the time he got back, because it was rather cool inside that spacecraft.
Yes,
they were
conserving
everything they could.
That's right. I can remember the frogmen that are part of the recovery team stated after they had brought the crew back to the carrier that when they opened the hatch on the command module, they actually could feel the cold air coming out of the command module. It was still that cold inside.
Down in the balmy, warm South Pacific where they splashed down. Boy, were they glad to open that hatch and get out.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah, so these simulators here at, for the command module, the lunar module, here at Cape Kennedy and in Houston, the lunar rover, I believe the Boeing company, has that out in Seattle. And you, as you've heard us say here, the rocket stage simulations are up in Huntsville, Alabama. I know that there's some LEM mechanisms at the factory where the lunar module is made up out on Long Island. There's many things that can be checked out where North American builds the command and service module out in California. And this whole nation is crisscrossed with instant communication with these builders of these mechanisms when such a checkout is needed. So there is the Apollo 17 rocket sitting on its launch pad right now, 5 kilometers in front of us. Astronauts Schmidt, Evans, and the commander of the mission, Gene Cernan, patiently waiting while the fellows up in Huntsville, Alabama, about 500 miles away from here, not quite that far, about 500 kilometers away, about 300 miles from here, check out the procedures to be followed. I think the weather has cleared a bit as we've waited down. I see more stars up there. I don't see our great searchlights out there shining on any clouds at the moment. I can still see out in the Atlantic an occasional flash of lightning in some of those very localized thunderstorms. It could be heat lightning, but I believe it's in some. There does appear to be a considerable amount of cloud formation out to sea, where there's some warm currents from the water causing some thundershower buildups. But they're completely away from here, at least it appears so at the moment. And the weather systems affecting this launch are coming from the northwest and west, and it appears to have cleared even more. Yes, we have I see a lot more stars straight over us. We're outside on the sands of Cape Kennedy. It's getting a little chilly here. It's almost midnight here in the United States on the East Coast. 14 minutes until midnight. T-minus 8 minutes and holding. We still have about another 10 minutes in this hold period. Don Beatty, the Skylab missions, which will come after the Apollo flights, are designed to do what? How about a planner's evaluation of why Skylab, this Earth-orbiting space station?
Well, this is going to be our first attempt to put a real space station in orbit around the Earth. It will be a very large craft in which the crews will live for up to 56 days continuously. And they will be living in what we now see out on the launch pad as the third stage of the rocket, which has been modified into a living quarters and will give them the equivalent of a three-bedroom house in which to live in. So while they're on the missions, they'll be conducting many, many experiments. The number of experiments, I believe, is in excess of 200 that they'll be conducting throughout the lifetime of that program.
Mm-hmm.
These will be astronomical experiments, biological experiments. We'll be looking back down at the Earth, taking high-resolution pictures, and learning some of the things that we'll be able to do from Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm. And then, hopefully in 1975, will come that cooperative flight with the Soviet Union, that docking or linking mission between Soyuz and Apollo.
That's right. That's scheduled for 75, in which we will join up with a Soyuz spacecraft that will be launched first. Then we will launch an Apollo. They'll rendezvous, dock, and stay together for a week or more, do cooperative experiments, and then come back home again.
And one other thing I promised to ask you more about there a few minutes ago, and that is what can you continue to see or get in electronically transmitted data coming back from the experiments packages left on the surface of the moon? You say if that thermoelectric, that radioisotope generator continues to work in all of these different LSEPs, or in some of them, what can you get years and years from now that won't be repetitious? What new information could come from this sort of thing?
Well, the first thing that is of importance on the LSEPs is to try and determine something about the internal structure of the moon. Now, up until this point, the moon and the meteorite environment in which we live has been rather cooperative. And just a short time ago, the principal investigator, Dr. Gary Latham, announced that he saw a very large impact on the back side of the moon, which transmitted seismic energy all the way through the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the first such event that he saw, and based on the information that the ALSEPs sent back to Earth, he's come to a tentative conclusion that the moon has a liquid core. Now, he'll need more impacts of this type to confirm that sort of information, and since these are rather random events...
This Apollo Saturn launch control, we're continuing in our hold at the T-minus 8-minute mark. Back at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, crews there are at work on a breadboard or a mock-up of the system in question, where they're putting it through its paces, checking out the workaround solution that is jumping around this erroneous signal, and ensuring that everything works properly. The crew still standing by in the spacecraft, updating various systems there, updating their flight plan, all continuing to go well there. The crew at the manned spacecraft center also doing considerable amount of updating. They'll be continuing to update the azimuth and the launch control center here at Kennedy Space Center. The launch team manning their consoles, standing by to pick up the count when we're given the word to go. However, we're standing by still at this time. We have no word from the Marshall Space Flight Center. We're expecting that to come within 10 to 15 minutes from this time. Now, T-minus 8 minutes and holding. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
And there's our latest status, 8 minutes, and the clock has stopped. It has not been picked up yet. The launch window closes at 1:31 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. That means we still have an hour and 40 minutes until to get this launch off this evening. Don, is it safe to say that really cosmic events themselves will determine the eventual usefulness of the ALSEP, because it depends on what meteorite strikes or what new events affect the
That's
old
right.
moon
the,
up there?
We're monitoring many, many phenomena on the moon,
mm-hmm.
and our present philosophy on the ALSEP is that we will continue to monitor these stations as long as they're mm-hmm. giving us significant scientific data.
Well, we've heard a good bit of the pre-launch recorded conversations with Schmidt and Cernan about what they'll be doing on the surface. Let's hear this one with Ron Evans, which Jim Parisi recorded in Houston, about his busy activity with those scientific experiments in the command module.
Ron, you're the man that the men on the surface of the moon really want to know is up there and going around. You're the command module pilot. Now, you're not going to be just sitting there doing nothing as you're circling the lunar surface. What will you be doing?
Well, I'm going around the moon. I will essentially be operating what we call a scientific instrumentation module, or the SIM bay. I call it SIM bay. And it has essentially two cameras in it to take pictures of the moon as we're going around. And then it also has three brand new scientific instruments back there. One of them is what we call an ultraviolet spectrometer, and basically this is nothing more than a little gadget to measure what kind of air, what kind of atmosphere, what is in the atmosphere around the moon. And then another one is what we call an infrared scanning radiometer, and that's a fancy term for a thermometer. It's a thing that measures the temperature of the lunar surface from orbit. And then we have another gadget up there that's a lunar sounder. And this lunar sounder is essentially a kind of a radar or something that zaps an electronic wave down to the lunar surface and then is reflected back up and picked up by some antenna that stick out on the command module. The antenna stick out about 40 feet on either side of the command module. Then two of the frequencies of the lunar sounder go down to about a kilometer below the lunar surface. As the electronic wave is reflected back up and recorded in the spacecraft, then we are able to interpret this wave and determine what kind of material is down below the lunar surface. Is there any water? Is there a pocket of water down there? This will be recorded. Is there a pocket of molten lava down there? Is there a pocket of cooled lava? Is there a pocket of gold? We don't know for sure, you know, what's going to be down there. But the lunar sounder will help us determine, and hopefully we'll get some good information and map a strip all the way around the moon as to what type of material is underneath the orbital track.
And you'll be doing an awful lot of picture-taking, too, yourself.
Yes, and of course, while these instruments are operating, I have to turn them on and off and pull the antennas in and out and also turn on the SIM bay cameras. The mapping camera and the pan camera, and then within the cockpit I have a handheld cameras, two or three handheld cameras, and I'm looking out the window taking pictures of the Terminator, which is the lunar sunset and sunrise. We get some very good pictures from these areas. We also have several areas on the moon that need to be, where we need to get some more colored pictures from. So I have colored film up there taking colored pictures of various spots on the moon.
You'll be doing a lot of picture taking with your mind, in essence, too.
Yes, very much with my mind, and also utilizing man's capability to interpret what he sees. In other words, no matter how many pictures you take of the moon, the best camera can't record the observations as well as the eye. And then the human mind, hopefully I will have the capability to interpret what I see down there, make a geologic interpretation of the processes of the moon.
You've called yourself a geologist who doesn't have to get his feet dirty.
That's right. I'm an airborne geologist.
You're going to be the only man in the command module as it circles the moon while Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt are on the surface of the moon, but you're not going to be the only living being in the command module, are you?
Oh, I guess, yeah, that's right. we're carrying an experiment that's called BioCore, and essentially six little pocket mice. They're all sealed up in their own little tube down there, and they have their own oxygen supply. And it's essentially a passive experiment, and I won't get the opportunity to watch them really because they're encased in a metal little metal box. But the purpose of this is to see what type of what the cosmic radiation does to these pocket mice. In other words, they can't operate on us to see how it affected us, but they can't operate on the mice and do that.
Well, it's going to be an exciting time for you, even though you're not on the lunar surface. Ron Evans, command module pilot of Apollo 17, and from Houston, Texas, and the Manned Spacecraft Center, this is Jim Parisi for the Voice of America.
Well, let's see if we can recap what has happened here in the delay in the launch of Apollo 17. We're at T-minus 8 minutes and holding right now after having backed up the count to T-minus 22. At 30 seconds before normally scheduled liftoff at 9:53 at 2 hours 53 GMT, at T-minus 30 seconds, only a half minute before liftoff from the launch pad, an automatic control system shut down the whole rocket system because a pressurizing monitor in the third stage of the rocket in the liquid oxygen tank showed that the oxygen tank was not coming up to full pressure fast enough. The flight engineers in the control center saw this happening, manually pressurized, and but not fast enough to catch this automatic monitor, which was in operation, and as it's supposed to, it shut down the count. So then the engineers analyzed what had happened, recycled to T-minus 22 minutes, counted down to T-minus 8 minutes. This was done, the T-minus 8-minute mark was reached 45 minutes ago, and we've finished two 20-minute holds and are now into another 20-minute hold, while the engineers here in the flight center and at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, where the big rocket system was designed, are testing out what they called a workaround solution so that when this automatic sequencer again gets down to T-minus 30 seconds, their workaround solution may be cranked into the system and fool, we might say, the automatic sequencer so that automatically all of these rocket systems can go on toward a normal liftoff. They think they've analyzed the problem properly and expect the launch now to go sometime within the next half hour. This is Rhett Turner at the Cape Kennedy Launch Center at the press site in front of the great Saturn rocket. We'll be standing by to report more from you after this news from Washington.